Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. Welcome to another English episode of Markenkraft. My name is Olaf Hartmann and today I have the pleasure of speaking about the principles of effective advertising that help grow your brand. Brands today have endless choices to communicate, as budgets are always limited. Two questions are important. What is the best combination of media? And what makes our creative effective? To find the answers to these questions for your brand is very important and can develop even into a competitive advantage as you squeeze more effect from every euro spent. More money than ever is poured into media. More than half go into the digital ad sphere. They promise laser-sharp targeting and no waste. But the efficiency and effectiveness of campaigns are declining for years. Some say that is connected with a more and more fragmented media landscape. But is that really the truth? What other factors are responsible for the decline? And if we can identify them, what can we do about it? What role does advertising play in general in building strong brands? It is complex, and therefore it needs very clear thinking and experience. And one person that can provide both is my guest today. Dan White has a career that includes decades as an inside professional, another decade as a chief marketing officer, and a third one as a brand advisor. Dan co-developed Brand Z, the world's biggest brand equity measurement system, and his thinking has shaped the design of leading copy tests and brand tracking systems. He has advised famous billion-dollar brands on how to thrive, and his summaries and trademark drawings, which he published in a series of books and on LinkedIn, are praised by some of Markenkraft's most prominent English-speaking guests like Jenny Romaniuk, Kuhn Powells, Paul Feldwick, or Mark Ritson. Albert Einstein said, "If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough." Well, Dan proves with his great illustrations and concise advice again and again that he is somebody who really understands evidence-based marketing and brand building. Welcome, Dan. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Wow. That introduction, I'm going to bottle that and use it because that sums up exactly how I think of what I'm trying to do.
That's fantastic. I always say that behind strong brands stand strong people. So Markenkraft always starts with who my guest is as a person. So let's start with a very narrow question. How did you become who you are today?
Wow, it's a deep question. It's narrow, yep. But it's deep. I think through the lucky experiences I've had through my career, I think it's been my career's been shaped by working with people who I learnt from, yeah, people who I respected, people who knew what they were talking about and were prepared to answer my stupid questions. Hmm.
And looking back, like really far back, what was the first money you ever earned with some kind of job? And then what was your first real job?
I think I remember my first salary after I went to university and then I found a job. I think it was £10,750 per year, which at the time was impressive. It may not sound impressive these days, but it was a good amount of money back then. I think it was, when was it? 1999, something like that.
And what did you get the money for? What was the job?
I started off in market research.
Hmm. Oh, immediately.
As it was called back then. Consumer insights, as it's usually referred to these days. Yeah. I worked for Kantar. Well, what became Kantar. But I was in the Millward Brown part of Kantar, which specialized in brand tracking and advertising pre-testing. So I learned a lot about advertising and how advertising builds brands. But by the time I left Millward Brown, I'd researched something like 500 advertising campaigns over the years. That was my heartland.
Right. And if we go back a little bit further, like in your childhood, what was the first job you ever got paid for?
Photocopying. I was photocopying. Back further. No, my first paid job was for developing old black and white film, like before digital photography. You know, you had the film, and it was quite hard because not many people still did it back then. You had to know how to take the film out of the camera, load it onto this drum in the dark. So you had to do it by feel, yeah? And then you had to have all the right chemicals to, you know, develop it. And then you need to have a projector to then project onto the paper and then develop it. It was magical. I loved it. And I did it with my dad. So it was a nice bonding experience. That's the first job I ever got paid for.
Right, by your dad or by somebody else?
No, by a photographer who realized that, you know, no one else pretty much did this anymore, because you couldn't send it off to Boots. Sorry, Boots is the UK pharmacy that used to do film photography. They'd stopped doing black and white photography. So some artists still use black and white photography back then. We're talking in the 1980s, I suppose. Yeah. They paid me to do it quite handsomely, if I remember.
Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I had my own dark room and I was doing exactly this kind of fiddling the films into those containers. And
I know, you had to do it by film.
If you got it wrong, you got a serious problem.
If you had any light coming in, you'd ruin all your photos.
Yeah, but then there was this magic moment where you put this, when you slid this white paper into the liquid, and then suddenly
it starts to develop
and the picture appears. That most people know from Polaroid, you know, when they were waiting for the Polaroid.
That's very similar. But you had to catch the right moment, because if you left it too long, it would go too dark. So you had to catch the right moment and then put it in the fixative, was it called? I think it was.
Fixative, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Otherwise it would change.
Overexposed, yeah.
That's right. Interesting. And from the money that you earned back then, what was the first brand that influenced the decision? Do you remember that? Where you consciously decided for buying a brand?
First brand I remember being persuaded by, you mean?
Yeah, like just where you felt, oh, the brand made a difference. It's like I chose this product, I bought this whatever.
That's a good question. I think I have an answer. Well, I had an answer that just came to my mind. Hmm. It was, I think it might be dead now. Is it dead now? JVC. Do you know the brand JVC?
JVC. It's a Japanese hi-fi equipment.
Hi-fi equipment, yeah? Yes.
There you go.
JVC, similar to Hitachi or Sanyo or Sony. Yes, JVC at the time was the kind of quality but affordable positioning for hi-fis or ghetto blasters, as we used to call them back in the day.
And they were very important, you know, like what you spend your money on and what tapes you bought. Was it the TDK or the Maxwell? And
you know, you're going to lose all your young audience here, but that's fine.
That's okay.
I love the fact it had two cassettes. One to copy. One to play and one to record illegally.
Oh, wow. So you were a bootlegger.
Yes.
We're a bootlegger.
Yeah,
we have it on tape. We don't have it on tape now.
I didn't sell them. I didn't sell them, so I can only go to prison for like 1 month. No, yeah, I used to record my friends Adam and the Ants albums and so I could have a copy.
Oh, fantastic. So now we established how old we are, but back to the present day.
Yes, okay.
So let's try to make our experience count. Before we talk about advertising effectiveness, let's talk about the goal of advertising. What, in your opinion, is brand strength? And what role does advertising play in creating or maintaining it?
Well, brand strength is, I guess, the effect of marketing activity that you've invested in, obviously, to build in the mind of the consumers or potential consumers some value, I suppose. It ends up being value. Actually, what's in the head of consumers is just associations. It's memories. It's helping the brand to become a very powerful and compelling idea in the mind when people are thinking about buying a category. But that's what you know. Advertising is primary role is to create those associations. And those associations are very powerful when people are thinking about buying a category, because they help the brand come to mind, be easily recognized, and it biases them to choose that brand. You know, we're all more likely to buy something that's familiar or that just spontaneously comes to mind when we're thinking about a decision. That's just, we're biased that way. We think that whatever comes to our mind is the right choice. We're very arrogant in that sense, but evolutionary, from an evolution point of view, that's a good thing. We need to make quick decisions, right? It's like, if that's our immediate response to something, it's probably right. So I've gone off on a tangent already, but
no, fantastic. That's what we're here for. We go on many tangents in this podcast. Like the people listening, we are brand nerds. We can nerd out on.
Okay, we can nerd out.
We can nerd out, and then we bring it together on a very practical level in the end.
Cool. Because I sometimes go back to, you know, basic instincts, let's call it. Not the film necessarily, but I'm thinking more. Again, that shows our age. I'm thinking more. You know, we respond to things that are in an instinctive way. We can't help ourselves. And that's like go on.
Like you would say, which I would agree to, that brand is more than a commercial phenomena. It's more like a phenomena from nature, that it helped, that it was like a survival mechanism of saving energy. Like creating patterns, which helped us make decisions.
Help us make decisions quickly, because our brains cannot spend a lot of precious mental energy on making decisions about everything in our life. We don't have the capacity. Our brains don't have the capacity to think hard about every single decision. When you're going around a supermarket, you can't decide rationally and think through every single choice, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to pick up the kids at 3:15. You know, it just doesn't add up. So we have to make most of our decisions in most of our daily lives based on instinct, or just quick heuristics, they call it. You know, a quick, and you just, and that's what most brand decisions are made from. And what biases us is whatever comes to mind when we're thinking about making the decision in the first place.
Yeah. So like 2% of our body weight is our head, and it uses 20% of our energy. So it makes complete sense. Like not to overexhaust it.
We can't. We can't because it
burns too much sugar, which used to be in short supply. Not today anymore. But
exactly. If you waste all the sugar thinking about things you don't need to think about, you won't have any sugar left to run away from the saber-toothed tiger.
Okay, so we got a nice model now here. Okay, so we got this phenomena of brand, and in moments of decision, it just helps us. It makes us quicker decisions, safer decisions, helps us survive. Okay, and now we look at advertising, because that's the topic. Because the problem with you, and I want to come back to your books and everything, I can talk with you about anything. And that's a problem for a podcaster, because we could have like a 3.5-hour podcast and we wouldn't exhaust the topics that we can talk about. So we would like to focus a little bit on the advertising effectiveness topic. So we establish now brand helpful in moments of decisions, in moments of needs, helps us save energy, and so on and so on. And now we look at the advertising, the role of advertising. Yeah, brands don't only grow from advertising, but advertising is an important part of it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they grow from, like you say, other things. All experiences will shape how we think of brands and what the brand, the brand memories or associations in the brain. Advertising is one of the important factors that can help make that brand powerful, in the sense of make that brand the one or one of the ones that comes to mind when people are deciding what to buy. And I think it does this by adding new or strengthening existing mental associations, right? In other words, it's making those the way the brain works is it's just a whole lot of neurons, and the brand name and the brand logo and the other things associated with brand are just a connection in the brain. Right, and advertising can strengthen those or add new ones that make the whole network of associations more powerful and more likely to fire when people are either thinking about buying the category or when they see the brand because they're browsing. And those two things make the brand come to mind really powerfully. You know, the neurons fire and more neurons fire if advertising has helped to build new and stronger connections. Does that make sense?
That makes, yeah, totally. So the mental availability that's needed, it's like what fires together wires together.
Yeah, exactly.
So
I love
advertising,
that phrase.
Advertising makes the neurons fire together and strengthening the mental highways, you could say. Yeah, that it's difficult to deviate. It's like you just go on that highway and whoa, and the thought is
like it becomes an instinctive reaction because your brain will just, your neurons will just fire whether you like it or not if they are connected strongly.
Yeah,
and I think that's a really important point. And this takes me back when I in my training sessions, I focus on Pavlov. You know Pavlov's dogs?
Yeah,
I'm sure
the
you
dog.
Do.
Yeah, let's repeat for our younger listeners. Yeah, so we're talking about here about conditioning and a bell and something.
In my training, I always ask the audience to describe what they remember from Pavlov's dog's experiment. What do you remember from it?
I remember the dog being fed when the bell was ringing. And after a while, you could see that he was starting to, I don't know, how do you say that in English?
In English, salivate.
Salivate. So prepare for taking the next bike and is about to, anticipation.
Exactly. The key thing was they would salivate when the bell rang, even if there was no... food.
That's after a while. In the beginning, they always connected the bell with the food. And after that was conditioned, only the bell would already create the physical reaction.
Yeah. And obviously before that, a bell would not make a dog salivate. But it proves that in the brain of the dog, the brains of the dogs, a strong connection had been formed between the sound of the bell and the idea of food, and therefore the salivation reaction. And it's such a basic idea, and this is like classical conditioning. It's memory. It's the kind of building block of all memories. Now, that's important to note because then when you think about it, when you're advertising a brand, you need to make sure that the brand name or the existing brand associations are present, are activated when people are experiencing the ad so that you can increase and enhance those connections.
Because that's like the bell, like the distinctive brand assets that we talk about later. But you just gave me, let me go on a tangent to talk about you a little bit more because you just said trainings and I train people and then I ask my audience, And you are like a teacher of this industry. You're teaching us for years with your illustrations. And for people just, I can't imagine, but for people just who don't know what you're doing, like let me describe what how I got to know you and because evidence-based marketing, there are many, many studies out there. There's an enormous body of knowledge, and the accessibility is not always so perfect. So you sometimes are surprised when you talk to marketeers how little they know of things that have been proven many times. And you basically help by making illustrations and creating very simple to understand structures, like visually, that convey a very complex message. But let me just ask the question, how did that come about? And how did you start drawing? And how did you create books from that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. I think it started... probably when I was back within market research, you know, within Kantar was my company. Over years, I moved into training roles, to impart my learning and experience onto the next generation kind of thing. And I found that, well, for a start, I used to draw little diagrams for myself, I suppose, as in, so I'd remember an important concept, I'd scribble something. Because I'm very visual, I like to capture it. And I had this whole stack of, I'm showing you this. I know this is an audio podcast, so your audience can't see, but I'm holding up an A5 notepad.
Yep, yellow.
Well, this one's yellow because it was from Wimbledon. I bought it from Wimbledon at double the normal price of a notepad last year. But that's not the point. The point is I used to always record things with pencil in an A5 notepad, over about 25 years, for me, so I could look back and go, oh, yeah, I get it now. I remember I did a scribble, and that helped me remember the concept, because I'm a visual person. Now, I noticed, though, when I moved into a training role within Kantar, that people responded well to some of my scribbles. So I made them a bit clearer, you know, got the rubber, the eraser out and made them a bit clearer and tried to develop my drawing skills. And then I used them in training, to help other people understand what I understood from when I learned it. And they turned out to be very popular, so I carried on doing that. So I ended up with my training was a series of illustrations.
Drawings. Yeah, right.
A drawing.
And I think there's more going on than just the visualization also for you, for yourself, why you remembered it so well, because, you know, like there was also the physical creation of...
That helps me.
So for you, that was definitely a booster for learning. But I think that also those hand-drawn drawings, they also activate, like when you look at them, you always like you simulate like how they are drawn. You know, it's like there's more multi-sensory associations going on than when you see something which is just printed.
I've heard somebody drawing it. I've heard this before. I didn't realize this. This wasn't a conscious thing, but I have heard that does. There's something about hand-drawn illustrations that gets people thinking about the person who drew it and why they drew it that way. That gets the thinking going, which I think I'm pretty sure now that I've published the drawings in books and I've had nice response that people go, oh, okay, you know. It does have that effect. I don't know why, but there have been apparently scientific studies that suggest that hand-drawn illustrations are easy to remember and are more convincing than
Correct.
Non-hand-drawn. You know,
actually, the wife of Amos Tversky, you know, the famous research partner of Daniel Kahneman.
Oh yeah.
She wrote an amazing book called Mind in Motion. And that explains that very much, you know, like 40% of our brain is doing nothing else than planning, analyzing, and executing motion.
Projecting motion.
Yeah. It's like also the actual, like the actual moving, but it's also the planning and the analyzing of what you have done and also what you see. And so that explains that. So the brain is highly activated. So the more, so that also like, you know, the famous Simon Sinek golden circle talk, the TED talk.
Yeah.
I think it would have been completely different if he would have shown this as a PowerPoint.
Yeah, but he drew it. Circles, yeah. A circle and then another circle. Yeah. Even though it's been widely discredited since, that's a whole different topic. Yeah.
But it's completely misunderstood because he was talking about leadership and not branding. And people adapted it completely. This is the branding model.
No,
that
but you're
will
right.
Everything.
And I found that in my training workshops, I don't do much face to face because of, you know, the way the world has moved on, of course. But I used to find that, I would prefer to go up to a flip chart with a big, thick marker. And when I did that, the audience was watching much, much more intently than if, like you said, I just shown it on a PowerPoint. Yeah. And I hadn't realized that until you just suggested it, that it's to do with our innate desire to or need.
It's mental simulation also.
Yeah.
It's like a multi-sensory mental simulation.
Projecting or predicting movement is really important, you know. This takes us back to the saber-toothed tiger, you know? If it's coming towards us, we need to react. If it's going away from us, we can calm down a little bit.
That's very good. And that's why in advertising, but it's like in advertising, when you see people looking in a certain direction and you place your headline there, you can be sure that the headline will be read more intensively.
We talk about.
And it's also a projection of the person might move in that direction because it sees something interesting.
Important. People look at what's important. So the brain is wired this way. Thank you. This is a really new idea that I hadn't come across.
That's why we meet.
I know exactly. I did some animations once with a piece of software called Doodly, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was I found it a little tricky to use, but I did do it. And it was basically recreating some of my diagrams, but as if being drawn, like animated the drawing process. And there was something about them that I loved. It was hard to, I didn't find it very easy. Well, it took ages to actually use, but I thought there's something about this. It was like compelling, and I think you've helped explain it. I'll ask you for the reference later for Daniel Kahneman's partner.
I'm happy that it's the wife of his partner.
Oh, really?
Amos Tversky was Daniel his Kahneman's research wife. Partner and his wife. Yeah. And this explains also the popularity of these unboxing videos. is like on YouTube. Why do people enjoy watching other people unboxing things? It's about projection. It's like, what's going to happen next, and how does this feel? And it's there's lots
to do
going
with the
on
movement and the
in the movement.
Wow.
But going back to your that you basically teach such important knowledge, and there is so much knowledge in marketing. But on the other hand, I noticed that in all the other industries, if you look at engineering, if you look at physics, like we build, there's a cumulative effect of learning. It's like every generation becomes smarter than the generation before. And in marketing, definitely that is not the case. Every generation throws everything out, declares media for dead, certain media channels dead, and the new solution is XYZ. But also like imparting this knowledge seems to be very difficult. What is your perception? Because you have a lot of experience in imparting knowledge. Why would you say, is it so difficult?
That's a really, really good question. And I did consider this when I was working back in a research agency, because, you know, every year it's fine to say it, at Kantar, you know, we would have new pre-testing clients, you know, clients who come and ask us to help them to improve their advertising. And sometimes if we worked with a client for 5 years, say 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, even in some cases, we were able to improve advertising, you know, double or triple its efficiency. But the thing was, that was very rare. More common was that we would have a new marketing manager who would commission us for, I don't know how long a marketing manager stays in a job these days. It's probably less than 2 years, you know, 18 months.
Average 10 years, 18 months for a CMO.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So that's fine. So we'd work with them for 18 months. Then they leave and we get a new younger, well, not necessarily younger, but often younger one who didn't know, and we'd carry on. So it was a very good business model in the sense that you'd be working with people. But the
you
question,
teach the same thing over and over.
Yeah,
and
over and over again. It's a good business model for advertising, but it's not very satisfying. You know, you're not helping to increase the overall effectiveness of all of your clients or the industry even more widely, which is a bit disappointing. So I think it's partly one of the answers to your question is that the tenure of the average advertising or marketing executive is so short. Mm. And often they move into different industries even. So there's that. And I think, I don't know, there must be other reasons. There must be other reasons why the industry itself has resisted learning. But I have never quite figured it out, I'll be honest. Mm.
Okay, I would be interested. I was interested if you might have a theory around it. But if you look, like, I'm always amazed how much knowledge is also given away in this industry. Mm. If I look at all the white papers, also Kantar has some excellent white papers. They're amazing. But when I look at the effect of these white papers, like how slow the knowledge translates into practice, I'm puzzled also, because it's like it's shown, it's explained, it's even proven with numbers, you know, like people that follow a certain mental model, they are more successful than others, and nevertheless it's not the general practice. Any ideas?
Well I think there's lots of factors, actually. I mean, one is there's too much. There's just too much. I mean, if you follow, you know, the right sort of hashtags and people on LinkedIn on any one topic, you'll be bombarded with it. I mean, there's just every day you'll have 3 or 4 or 5 different posts around the topic. And that's too much to take in. And although they're not necessarily contradictory, they appear contradictory unless you've had someone to help reconcile them, you know?
There's always a caveat that you need to
there's always a caveat. It's very complex. Intellectually, it's very complex to kind of make sense of that. And I've been doing this for 35 years, and I still find it hard to go, oh, hang on, does that fit or not fit? Where does that fit? Oh, it does fit. Oh, God, that's complex. You know, there's a lot to take in. And then compounded with the fact that you've got different people coming in and out of the industry, over time, so that the learning doesn't build. And then, unfortunately, you also have certain people with certain agendas or certain companies with certain agendas that might overemphasize certain things and underemphasize others. That becomes quite confusing for your average user, you know, marketer. One of the reasons I try, I do what I do, is to try and simplify that and to make sure that everything is based on science. And even then, I'm not, you know, it's not perfect. I still have a few things I think on my website that aren't, you know, that aren't obviously reconciled. But I do my best to try and distill it down to the things that have been proven that fit with everything else.
And definitely, that's one format which I find most useful. And you're doing a great job there. It's really like something overviews. Those books are amazing. We're going to link to all of them in the show notes. And a question from my colleague Linus was like, your personal, like what is for you the most valuable source? Like what format do you enjoy? TED Talks, or what is for you the best format to take in new knowledge?
This format. Yes. Talking to people has always been my favorite thing. I've learned more by arguing or discussing, arguing. You know, it's like if I say, you know, well, there's this piece of evidence and there's this piece of evidence and I can't make sense of it, some very clever person out there probably will go, well, this is why. Yeah. And therefore, talking to intelligent people, that's why I love doing podcasts with people like yourself. It's like it helps you think these things through, I think. So for me, it's talking with really, really clever, experienced people has been, and to be honest, I'd love to give a shout out to LinkedIn here, because LinkedIn has helped me learn and explore more things, you know, because it's been so successful over the last 10 years. I just absolutely love it. And, you know, every day I learn something new from just scrolling through on LinkedIn. So, yeah. It's a huge thing, but and effectively that's an indirect way of talking of interacting with other people. You know,
you're right.
You read what they've written. Sometimes you ask them a question, and they respond, because that's the thing. They respond. So that has been an amazing resource.
Yeah, I totally agree from my experience also. And online, like this, what we're doing now is great. But actually, meeting people in a room and really discussing intensively is still a format which is not going to go away. And people always said, you know, everything is going to move digital. It's not going to happen. And there's also something on that level that we just discussed, that like multi-sensory signals that you just pick up and certain energies in the discussion that just stick. They make you remember things much better. So let's go back to the topic that we want to discuss. But thank you very much for your perspective on this. Advertising effectiveness, it all starts with creative. Can you just take us through what makes creative? What makes a great ad from your experience?
I think this is the hardest of all topics, to be honest, because creativity has this sort of elusiveness, a certain magic to it. And it is actually quite hard to put your finger on it. We know that creativity is the biggest variable in terms of advertising effectiveness that you can control, let's say. I mean, obviously, brand sizes has a bigger effect, but, you know, your brand size. But you do have some control over the creativity. And we know that, you know, weak, poor creativity has almost no effect on your brand and your success. And incredible breakthrough relevant creativity can transform your brand success. So we know it's the biggest variable, yet it's the hardest for a CFO to understand, because you can't guarantee it.
How would you try to explain it to him?
Yes, or her.
Why should he invest in this daring new campaign?
Exactly, or her. Yes.
Or her.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's so hard, isn't it? Because there is no guarantee, and you have to take a leap of faith. Now, I don't think it's a total leap of faith, because there are certain characteristics you can look for. And before you commit lots of money to something, you can check for them. But it's not something you can guarantee to your CFO. And I think that's what CMOs, struggle with. But striving for it is the right thing, because if you get the genius creativity that ticks all the boxes, it can transform the whole organization's commercial success.
And you were a CMO. What did you look for? So what are the things that you did look for without having the guarantee of this really going through
the roof? I didn't look for originality for originality's sake. I looked for original things that people haven't experienced before, you know, something new that nevertheless connected to what I was trying to do, and particularly to my brand. And I think that's really important, because some of the most amazingly creative, original advertising ever created, a lot of it didn't work. It didn't work because the brand that was being advertised was not central.
Can you give an example?
Oh, I hate to, because then I get lots of horrible emails and messages from creatives. No, I'd rather not pick a specific one.
But it makes it tangible. Oh, I give you an example.
Just say, if you look at about half of the Cannes award-winning creative ads, half of them were did not work. Mm-hmm. I've done this analysis in the past. Creative award-winning advertising has no correlation to effectiveness at all. Nothing. In fact, possibly, virtually no relationship, because it's about creativity and brand connection. If you get both of those, then you've got something really powerful.
From what you said in the beginning is like, attention is not everything, but without attention, obviously, everything is nothing, because it doesn't stick. Yeah. But then what sticks needs to be connected with the driver that makes your brand strong, like an association to category entry point, a certain positioning that your brand has. And if that association is not created, then...
It's even more simple than that. It's actually... the first thing I'd look for is creativity that's going to grab and hold people's attention. That is fundamental. Now, the next thing is just whether it's linked to your brand name. Your brand.
Right.
Your brand.
Okay. So it needs to activate the brand. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Activate the brand so that when people experience it, like we talked about earlier, when people are experiencing this amazing, creative, compelling experience, it links to the brand and strengthens those mental connections we talked about. Now, there is a tertiary aspect, which is what are those connections, but people put too much attention to the nature of the connections, and actually just creating those amazing connections are powerful. I've pulled up recently, right, okay, PG Tips, it's one of the biggest brands of tea in the UK, right, and when it was at its heyday, it's declined a bit since, but that's a different matter, it created these crazy engaging advertising using chimpanzees from the 1950s, 60s, 70s onwards. Obviously, more recently, it's been inappropriate because of the way they used the chimpanzees. But it was, at the time, it was very, very memorable. But it was nothing to do. It didn't communicate quality. They're chimpanzees. How can chimpanzees make quality tea? I mean, it makes no sense. But all it did, it made the brand hugely famous, right?
Mm. Now, very that, memorable, likable. Likeable. Mm.
Mentally available. Now, there is also the idea of quality, but a lot of how people assess quality is when they try the product and decide whether they like it or not, whether it works, whether it delivers, whether it's tasty in the case of tea or is reliable in the case of a service, etc. That's more to do with the product, not the advertising. Advertising's job, in my opinion, is to get people to pay attention. To build mental availability, salience of the brand, they'll judge quality in a different way.
Hmm. But that fits in well with the most successful Super Bowl spots of all time. You know, the puppy spot of Budweiser. And that broke the internet. Like, it's the most shared ever, the one with the puppy.
Is that the puppy with the horse or not?
No. It's the horse, exactly. Where the horse gets the puppy back, yeah?
Yeah, I didn't know that was the top one. It's one of my favorites, but yeah.
But the problem is it's not connected at all with any reason to drink beer. Beer doesn't even happen in that spot. And it only ends, like in the end, there's the Budweiser logo. So it could be anything. But every dog owner loves that spot. You know, yeah. I'm a dog owner and it's so sweet and it's just wonderful. And I remember the scenes and everything, but it just doesn't give me any reason to drink beer.
No, and in fact, I'd forgotten it was Budweiser. You know, it's not. No, you don't even need a reason to just to pick your. You don't necessarily need a reason, a rational reason to drink beer, but you do need for that.
To remember that I drink I drink beer, not why, but that I drink beer at all.
Remember that lovely memory of the puppy and the horses and the horse. That is a Budweiser ad. Hmm. You know, it's. That's the biggest flaw of advertising, and this goes back to my work at Cantel when I was doing a lot of advertising research. Is the biggest variable in terms of advertising effectiveness is whether or not the brand is or isn't strongly linked with what people will remember, and people don't remember everything. From that ad, I remembered a lovely relationship between a puppy and a horse. Right?
Right. Now, so let's talk about distinctive brand assets for that reason.
Yes.
So nice what role segue. Do they play there?
Yeah. Distinctive brand assets are a genius way of ensuring that whatever you're advertising will be strongly associated with your brand, so long as you've already established these wonderful things called distinctive brand assets.
Let's define them real quick.
Okay.
What is a distinctive brand asset?
Okay. For start, and this sounds like a obvious, it has to be distinctive. In other words, it's something that's unique, something that's not already strongly associated with lots of other things. Yeah. So distinctiveness comes first. And that's why things like brand characters that have been invented by the brand, you know, for the brand, are obviously distinctive. Because
and from all the, like, I remember the drawing that you did, the most ownable distinctive brand asset is even beyond the logo, because they can be still mistaken. You know, there are many logos
even
that
logos
look very
aren't the
similar.
Best. Yeah. Sometimes an additional graphic or character or it can be more distinctive. Yes, for example, it's a stupid, it's a very, very, very old example from 1847, I think. But the Michelin Man. Do you know the Michelin Man?
Yep.
He's distinctive. I mean, what looks like the Michelin Man? It's like this man with all these white tires. He's built out of, it's like bizarre. But that's distinctive. And therefore, okay, that's the start point. Is it something that's not already linked to other things? So you can uniquely own this asset. Then you need to link it to your brand. And that's not that difficult, because we're going back to Pavlov now. You just need to use it in association with your brand. Again and again and again and again. It builds over time. The more times you use it, whether your brand is there, your logo, whatever, and the thing, it becomes associated with it. Ronald McDonald is an example for McDonald's. I mean, there are so many. These are just characters.
But it's an interesting example, because it's being used much, much less. Like Ronald McDonald's, when we grew up, was used quite a lot. And
I agree.
Many big brands stop using certain distinctive brand assets, and so they become weaker and weaker in the association with the brand.
Yes, sometimes for good reason and sometimes for bad reason. I believe, this is just an opinion, okay, that Ronald McDonald's has been used less and less and less because he's creepy. And because of what's happened over time, and we realize that, you know, creepy old men are not necessarily a nice association. That's fine. But what McDonald's have done is they've built other associations. Do-do-do-do-do is one of them. I'm loving it, which goes with, obviously, that. That's another one. They continually do this. In the UK, they use the same actor's voice again. They've used him for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. He's a distinctive voice. And, you know,
the Golden Arches. And
the Golden
Arches.
They
have many, many distinctive assets that activate the brand without the logo.
Exactly.
And I just saw this it's an older outdoor ads. Like, why would you want to eat with a clown when you can eat with the king? Like a king.
Exactly, the king, Burger King. That's a good asset.
The king
is a good asset. The crown is a good asset.
Yeah.
But people, I think marketing shun. Not saying marketing, but the ad agency world likes to invent something new. They want to. So there's a tension, and creating something new that's going to last forever is a great thing. It's a wonderful thing. But if you're going to use that instead of reinforcing something that's already stronger and is still relevant or at least not inappropriate, like a creepy clown, that's a bad move to move away from something that's still strong and you could leverage. You know, I think, you know, the more assets, distinctive brand assets you've got, the more you keep using them, the stronger your brand tends to get. And those assets can be used in your current advertising to make sure that when people are experiencing that advertising, it comes to mind just like the bell, just like
So the bell, that is interesting. So basically the bell is like the creative platform, which is recognizable that you...
Established
platform. So let's talk about that a little bit, because I think that creative platforms also need patience and they need a certain way of thinking. And often I think they also go against the business model of agencies that always want to create the new kind of thing. And like, how do you create, what do you consider very good? Like, you didn't want to talk about the bad examples, but let's talk about some good creative platforms that you see. And what are their connections in effectiveness in advertising?
Well, I think any long-established platform that's distinctive almost certainly will help the brand. I just think a good example. One of my favorite examples is Hendrix Gin. It became one of the top 10 gin brands in the world, and it grew in the 1990s and 2000s. And what it did is it did everything right, in my opinion, from a branding point of view. Yeah. So the flavors are infused with cucumber and rose. So quite an interesting combination, especially before we had all the, you know, fancy gins that we see today. And its advertising had featured cucumbers, roses, but also this kind of Victoriana contraption. Do you know what I mean by that? It's a hard thing to describe, like kind of Victorian, in England, you know, Victorian era, you know, the idea of these kind of crazy new thing, newfangled devices that were being invented back in that time. And there's a very distinctive visual style that if you just Google for a second Hendrix, you'll see. And they've used it consistently for so long that there are so many elements. There's the cucumber, there's the rose, there's the Victorian, there's the contraption. There's all these things that make it highly distinctive and highly memorable and just different from all the other gins. And that has helped that platform. It's hard to define a platform because it can be built up from all of these different elements that they've used, and that's helped build their brand to where they are today.
But what you just described is like a world. And the world can be recognized by elements of that world. Like the world of France, you just show the Eiffel Tower and immediately the world comes. And then part of the world is the baguette and a certain type of music and immediately...
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Absolutely. Sorry, I don't mean to say... You're right.
And it's like we have some German brands here, like Hornbach. They also have this world around life being a project. There's always something to do. So it's always about this heroic struggle of people that have projects and try to realize these projects in their life. And it's a DIY store. Everything you need, obviously you can buy from them. Or maybe the Priceless campaign is also a type of platform which can take many forms and shapes. But it's united by this, okay, in the world there's always payment. Somehow, like, some money plays a role, but the important part is more than money, which you cannot buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard, so it moves everything out of the way. But then the original spot of the father going with his son to the baseball stadium and like all these prices, you know, the Coke, the hot dog, and the prices of that, and then a smile by a 13-year-old son, priceless. And that established a world, basically, of all the moments where things were more than money.
I think the idea of a world is a nice phrase because it sums it up. It's like a brand, the distinctive brand assets can be almost anything. The more distinctive, the better. but they can be almost any from any mode. Is that the right word? Mode. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it could be a theme or an idea. So that idea of priceless is it's a theme. It's an idea, right? A concept. Mm-hmm. It could be graphic. It could be, you know, colors and
graphic
logos.
Style, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Shapes and fonts and all these things are all relevant. It could be colors, of course, but it could also be even rituals. You know, like mm-hmm. I think some of the best brands in the world have a ritual associated with them, often to do with the consumption, not always. Mm-hmm. Rituals are another concept. Like Oreos, you twist, link, dunk. Twist, mm-hmm. link, dunk. That's quite a memorable concept, right? And you could use it in advertising.
Corona, the slice of lime.
Lime that goes in at the mm-hmm. end. That's, it's just a little, just makes it more memorable. Mm-hmm. There are so many examples like that. I mean, my favorite, the trouble is people don't know it from other countries, but I'm going to share it with you anyway. But it's called Chocolate Orange.
Chocolate Orange, never heard of
no,
it.
No, exactly. I don't think it's big in other countries, but it's wonderful. It's orange chocolate with an orange flavor. Yeah. Yeah. Very nice, by the way. It's got real orange oil in it. And it comes, you know, like segments. It comes in segments. Right. But the segments are stuck together a little bit when you buy it, obviously, because it has to hold its shape and you have to tap it. In fact, there's a phrase again, a slogan is another distinctive brand asset. And the phrase is tap it and unwrap it. You tap it and then unwrap it. It's in foil, right? You tap it.
Okay. We need what do we Google if people want to learn about this?
Terry's. As in Terry apostrophe S, chocolate orange.
Okay,
tap chocolate it orange. And unwrap it.
Okay, I will put it in the link, but if people remember Terry's.
Anyway,
okay, that's great.
You but get the idea.
Yeah.
Slogan, the name, the slogan, and the what you call it, the ritual.
Right.
It's part of what makes the brand more memorable than any other chocolate.
So, but to put this like for our listeners on a practical level. So, if you think about your own brand, does it live in a world? That's the first question. Is there a recognizable world? And then that makes also the role of characters why they are so powerful. Because characters can act in a world. They are in a place. They are in relation to other characters. Sometimes, you know, like the M&M characters, they move around, they do things, so they convey certain values and messages by the way they act. And so that's a practical question. Like, does our brand live in a world, or do we have disconnected certain symbols that we use often? Yeah,
I agree with that. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. I also think you don't have to start, you can start from anywhere. You know, you don't have to have this vision for this amazing world, but you do. There is a checklist. I genuinely think there's a useful checklist, which is you don't have to have all these, but you have to have some of these. Do you have a cool slogan? Do you have any characters? Do you have any colors? Do you have any rituals? Do you have any graphical symbols? Do you have any, I don't know, ideas or themes, let's call them? It's probably about 7 or 8 different things you could create as distinctive brand assets. But start with what you've got and then add more. The more you add, the stronger your brand will be, I think.
And important is not to do everything at one time. Like when I talked to Jenny about this, she said like building a distinctive brand asset costs a lot of money.
And a lot of time.
Because it needs a lot of time, repetition. So rather focus on the distinctive brand assets which are most valuable for you because of the channels that you turn up, because of the moments that they are connected with. And so step by step.
Yeah, exactly.
But never stop doing it. And what most startups do wrong, because often the startups, they have an amazing business idea. So they love that idea. And they start to build their distinctiveness up too late, because they forget that once their idea is really, they are right about that vision and that technical solution suddenly takes over the market, there will be quickly many people copying that technical solution.
So that happens always. Not just tech startups, any kind of product or category. If you've got something new that's valuable, you'll be copied. It will happen. It just that's the way of life, right? That's how it and therefore you need to build the brand alongside. And that, yeah, you're right. You're so and right.
You need to be distinctive. Unless, like, then suddenly that protects your
alongside.
Yeah. You need to do it as well. Yeah. So now we have whatever we want to convey. We have that world even. We have that idea. And now we want to get it into people's heads. So let's talk about something like reach or frequency. What is it what we need?
Oh,
like,
reach, do we need to? No, that's easy. That's too easy. Reach. Come on.
We need some easy answers as well.
Yeah, okay. Frequency. I get quite annoyed when I hear people saying, we need to have at least frequency of X. I don't care what X is. You know, 4, 5, 7. 7's often quoted, weirdly. No, not true. Just not. Just
evidence says otherwise.
Okay. There is some evidence that for a completely unfamiliar brand, right? Yes, the first exposure, you need a few exposures before the brand becomes kind of credibly familiar in the brain. Okay, yes. This is really rare. Okay, fine. And it's only a few. It's not like 10. In almost every scenario, reach is more effective than frequency, and all the data suggests that.
Right. That brings me to the next topic. But before we do a little bit, one more practical advice. So if I say reach, should I do this like in one burst, reach everybody? Or should I be always on and just spread out my investments constantly?
That's a bit more complex. I think the default position is always on. Spread it out. Spread it thinly. Doesn't matter. You know, even if it feels thinly spread, you know, the first exposure is better than the subsequent ones. So spread it thinly. There is, of course, a difference. The difference is if you're launching something and you need to get trade partners to be excited by it and happy about the fact that it's starting to sell quickly, concentrated at the launch moment. Yes, that's different. That's a tactical. That's because of the world we live in.
It gives your trade partners confidence to invest in you. So, but that has nothing to do with the effectiveness of creating brain structures and associations in the brains of your targets.
Exactly. Audience. If you want to build long term, you spread it out. Yeah, but no, that's the real world. Is you want sales to fly. To fly early on, so people go, "Woo, this is great. I'm going to sport it." Yeah, that's fine. The other reason you might not want to spread it out is seasonality. Okay. Because, mm-hmm. And certainly for, we haven't got into this, but when you're talking about activation spend, as in advertising that's designed to trigger people who are in the moment ready to buy, then I think it makes total sense to concentrate that around the times of year, if it's seasonal, around the times people are buying. That's fine. So concentrate activation spend around seasonal peaks in category spend.
So fitness studios, they should concentrate
January, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everybody wants to start January.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Activation spend to get people to sign up to a gym, January. Yeah, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. That's not about brand building. That's more about activation, as we call it, getting people to. But you could spread your brand building throughout the rest of the year. So as people are, they've given up on the gym in March, February, right? February. but they'll probably sign up to another one next January. You can build the brand through the whole year if you want. Spread it out. Yeah, that's different.
Yeah. So that brings us to the last large topic that we have time for, because I'm sure we're going to have a repeat episode. But because what you just said is reach over frequency. So if frequency is not what we want.
No.
What about retargeting ads? What about the rise of digital? Over 50% of ad spend is going into the digital sphere. And performance marketing has been the name of the game the last 10, 15 years. At the same time, we saw the decline in brand strength and also in effectiveness of campaigns. So give us your take on what is happening here. And it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, the tide is slowly turning due to examples like Airbnb that were, they couldn't do performance marketing during Corona.
And Nike
they had to
as well.
Do, yeah,
Nike
they had
to,
okay, that's the opposite example. Yeah. It's like, so they had to invest in brand. And suddenly after they turned on their performance again, they had this boost of effectiveness in their performance marketing due to the brand that they strengthened.
Well, I guess that's the key thing. The two interact. Yeah. Okay. Performance marketing is more effective if you've built a brand through brand building activity. That's pretty clear. That's been established. And that's where I think the Binet and Field evidence is so powerful. Binet and Field suggested from their findings that if you spend, on average, this is just an average, right? 60% on what you might call brand building advertising, getting the brand to be mentally available and relevant and, you know, compelling, and 40% on performance marketing, which is, you know, trying to trigger people when they're in the decision window to buy the category. Yeah. That 60-40 is a good start point. Yeah, 60-40. Now, that what's interesting about that is different from what a lot of brands were spending. They were spending the other way around, if not worse, if not more extreme. In other words, over-investing in performance. And that worked for a while, like the Nike example. You know, they had a good brand. They had a really strong brand from decades and decades. They put a lot of money into performance marketing, and that worked for a while because they were leveraging that equity, that brand. But after a while, the brand starts to become less powerful. The mental availability fades away. And then that means the performance advertising is trying to trigger people to buy stuff, a brand that they're less keen on than they were. And in the meantime, other brands like Skechers and I don't know who else have been doing really well. So the two go together. And I think you alluded to this earlier, which is that it changes depending on the brand's circumstances, right? A new brand should put more emphasis on performance marketing, but an established brand actually shouldn't. It just needs to remind people through brand advertising of how strong it is, and that makes the performance marketing more effective. So it's quite nuanced, but it's getting the balance right and how it varies over time.
But that's a very good point. And just to repeat that, is like depending on the life stage of your brand, the balance
changes.
It changes. Yeah. So in the beginning, you need to get the first clients to try your product.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really like be aggressive. Also build it from the inside out, like improve your product, make it, package it nicely,
da, da, da.
And do trials and so on and so on. And once you're known, once you're there, you need to reinforce, like Pavlov's dog, you need to reinforce the mental connections, what fires together, wires together. So that creates another mix that you need to adhere to get the most out of your investment.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if you look at the numbers, like if you look at digital, which is mostly performance oriented, that message hasn't sunk in.
No,
so
not yet.
You still have. I think you should write a whole book about that, like just the smart guide to getting away from the performance drug, because I think that the smaller companies, they Procter & Gamble, for example, they moved $200 million out of this micro-targeting and invested it, for example, in radio, where you thought like, okay, radio, isn't that dead? But they found that they could reach young people through radio because there's no danger of second screen, or hopefully not. Otherwise,
it's good for reach. Radio is good for reach. It's good for memorability. It's quite a brand-building medium, actually. Yeah. Yeah, and also because of where and when people consume radio advertising, or sorry, consume, it's a horrible expression, you know what I mean, actually there are often fewer distractions and people pay more attention than on social media where they're scrolling past within a split second. So it's all about channel attention. Radio is really good for attention. Each exposure, people pay attention for much, much longer than a typical social media ad.
That brings us to the topic of context, like the effectiveness of advertising depending on the context. Can you summarize some of the findings there?
I think the biggest thing is when you look at, you know, you pay for exposures, right? A brand owner will pay per thousand exposures. That's the currency, isn't it? But when you think about TV, let's take TV at one extreme. Well, cinema's the further one. But if you take TV, a 30-second ad that you pay for is looked at for about 13 seconds, about half. Not bad. You know, people look away, people leave the room, people whatever. But you've still got 13 seconds to communicate to them something, hopefully your brand, and some lovely memories or a message or both. Wonderful. The average exposure to most social media advertising, video advertising, is it's like 1.7 seconds, what, 1.5 seconds? That's a very, very, very different opportunity. And when you look at the relative costs of these things, you have to go, well, is it the costs on that aren't that different between the 13-second exposure, because TV is out of fashion, right, versus the 1.5-second exposure. But we know that longer exposures mean stronger memories, right? Well, as long as you use the time well, obviously. So you have to factor in the amount of attention, and that's why attention measures are becoming so important in media planning. You can't just rely on the reach. It's the effective reach or the memorable reach, whatever you call it, and that depends on how long you can typically hold people's attention through different media. And the differences are astronomical. You've got cinema at the top. Radio and TV are high. YouTube's nearly as high as TV, or about the same as TV. And then you've got social media lower. And then you've got digital display right at the bottom.
Right. So, but what this means, like, you cannot stack small amounts of attention onto each other and say we're going to reach the same effect in memory traces as if we would have a high quality contact in a high quality media where I have 13 seconds.
Yeah. And that, to be honest, that is the big debate. And that's the big debate between, say, Facebook versus TV. And I don't think we have a definitive answer on that. I don't want to say that's not the case. I think if you can be very clever about those multiple small exposures, maybe. But that's where distinctive assets become even more important, because otherwise you're not going to get your brand in there in 1 second unless you've got a distinctive asset that triggers the brand and rings the bell.
Yeah. And they need to be established, those distinctive assets.
Yes, and that needs to take years. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's stronger with its within storytelling. You need an episodic memory about what this distinctive asset actually does and what it means and so on. And then afterwards, suddenly it's triggered and the whole memory structure is activated.
Yeah, exactly. So But I think it's a big debate, actually, whether multiple small short exposures adds up to one longer. I have my opinion, which you can probably guess, but I don't have enough data to prove it yet.
And maybe it's in the middle as often. You know, it's the mixture of things. It's
But the role of distinctive brand assets is really important. If you don't have any, it changes everything. If you've got them, maybe lots of short exposures that feature the distinctive brand asset might be better value. If you don't, it's hard to imagine, because you need to establish those assets. So you probably need to use different media to establish the assets in the first place. So there's a big nuance between new brands that don't have any assets versus established brands that do. That's a really big distinction.
Yeah. And there's also another distinction which is not going to go away, is also the motivational state you're in while consuming the media. And there's a huge difference sitting next to your girlfriend in a dark room watching a huge screen compared to sitting on the toilet and scrolling through your Facebook feed.
True. Yeah.
So there's, even if the amount of attention would be the same, the situation triggers completely different motivational
I think the attention is different. I mean, and we have data on this. There's some good data on larger screens experienced with somebody next to you, or, you know, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a family member. The other one? Those two are important. The third one is also to do with the nature of the content, how exciting the content is. They have a massive influence on whether you're likely to remember the advertising. So the best scenario is huge screen with people you love or you're close to.
Or you want to impress.
It doesn't matter.
You want to impress whatever.
The other people you want to, and the content is highly engaging. That is a win. And that is probably why Super Bowl is the most expensive advertising you're going to have. It's fun. You watch it with other people, usually on a big screen, and it's you're in the middle of the biggest US sports event. But you can, and that's why sports content you should pay a premium for, right? And you should pay a premium for things that are watched on the big screen in the living room versus a small screen on your own on the toilet. Thank you for that.
Sorry. Okay. But actually, my favorite example is there. What everybody can immediately relate to, like the things that we would talk about if we would meet each other on a highway gas station, in the bathroom washing our hands, compared to in the champagne bar in the Adlon in Berlin. Yeah.
Well, like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, this is an invitation, Dan. So next time,
thank you. I do accept the invitation to the toilet.
The bathroom. But immediately everybody says, but you meet the same person. That's like selling you a target group. Yeah, but you meet the same person. But obviously, you cannot talk about the same things, and he will remember you in a completely different way from meeting you in the champagne bar compared to the highway.
Yeah. I get that. Yeah. And that's why Gucci doesn't use advertising that's under kind of railway arches in a, dodgy part of town. Yes, there is a bit of that. I actually think that tends to not be a big issue, I think. But you're right. Yes, the context is also important.
Yeah. So let's come to an end. It's not over yet, but let's look ahead. What do you see, like, with all this knowledge and all this experience? What do you see? What are the most important changes in the world of brand building and marketing in the next years? AI. More on the sense of what people should watch out for in their own behavior, in their own thinking about things, more like in the way that maybe is beyond the look squirrel kind of advice that everybody gets at the moment, the newest ChatGPT prompt guide.
It's a really hard question because I struggle to not think beyond the AI because the AI is such a big impact on all of us. But I'll try not to.
Not beyond. I mean, you can put it into that. Basically, what this means, because in the end, it's still a cognitive steam engine. Yeah, but nevertheless, you need to know what you want to do with that cognitive steam engine. So that's more what I'm getting at. It's like, what's the mental model we should think about all these new possibilities, which are amazing.
Well, I suppose, okay, I'm with you. It's hard not, like I said, it's hard not to think of AI as part of what we need to factor into the future. But I suppose, I'd start with creativity. Okay, at the moment, and this may change, right? If you do ask AI to create something for you, which of course is happening, the way AI currently works is it will look at what's happened before, right? It'll look at, you'll ask it to say, I want to create an ad in this category featuring this kind of thing with this kind of message or whatever, and it'll come up with something. It currently bases it on what's happened before because that's the data it's drawing on. So it tends to come up with an average, a generic. And we know that from history that the most effective brand building and advertising is not the generic. It's something that's never been seen before. So there is still an advantage at the moment for unique creativity, breakthrough creativity, not just generic average creativity, because that can be done by AI, but something that's never been done before and yet is still relevant. Now, that's a concept that's in my head. I'm worried about the future where you can also say to the AI, do all this, but make it unique, and then it'll do it for you. But you know, it's not there yet, all right? So that's one thought. Originality, I suppose I'd sum that up as, yeah? Mm-hmm. Never been done before, and yet relevant to what you want to do. That's one. There's something that you can't go away from, which is reach. And we talked about that before. Stop worrying about frequency. Stop worrying about expensive targeting. Reach will almost always be a better bet, in my opinion. Partly because the cost of reaching a specific group of people probably is more than the benefit of doing so versus the wider reach. That's kind of a principle in my... Well, I've not found any evidence to contradict that yet. Then the third one we've talked about a lot is branding. As in, linking what you've seen, you know, the ringing the bell and the food and all that, to the brand is not a guarantee. It's actually harder than people think. And people assume advertising is going to be better branded than it actually is. And that's where all this discussion about the value of distinctive brand assets is important, because they can really, really help that equation and make sure that things are always well-branded, because that's the biggest waste in advertising is if they're not. So I would say those are the three biggies, in my opinion.
Good. Very good. Also, just on the last point, I have seen studies where over 50% of the ads were not attributed to the right brand. So we're talking here 50% waste, complete waste, no memory traces whatsoever connected with the brand.
I think that's about right. I would say 50% is about right. I remember an old statistic, which is what's the average proportion of people who are shown an ad. Obviously, you have to de-brand that, which is... I remember the norm. It was 45% got the right brand.
Yeah.
So which confirms what you say. It's about 50-50. Half of it's wasted. It's a bit like Coleman's mustard. Have you heard that? Have you heard the thing about Coleman's mustard? Yeah.
But tell.
I think it was... I hate to get the references wrong, but Coleman's is a mustard brand, a famous UK English mustard brand. And he realized that more than 50% of his profit came from the 50% of the mustard that's left on the plate after people have had their meal, right? And it's a similar thing. You know, in advertising, 50% of advertising effectiveness is probably wasted because people don't link it with the right brand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And there's a big leverage there. Just improve the recognition, your distinctiveness, and you immediately have a powerful lever to pull. Yeah.
Yep.
And then that also answers the question, which I didn't ask before. How do you measure effectiveness of your advertising? For example, that your distinctive brand assets are more recognizable, because most people overestimate, that's what you just said.
Yes.
Overestimate their distinctiveness of, everybody knows that this green is us. Everybody knows that this shape is us. And then you measure it, and not even 10% of the people connect the color or the shape with your brand.
Yeah, I mean, I would refer people to Jenny Romaniak's book called Building Distinctive Brand Assets.
Absolutely.
Which is the definitive guide on this important topic. Yeah. There are fairly straightforward research approaches you can do to present people with assets and find out whether people are consciously aware of them or not at all, whether they're unique, and they can, you can use implicit methods like reaction times to see how quickly they can connect the assets with your brand. So you can have a pretty clear idea about which assets are actually already linked. And also she's got a lovely framework. Jenny's got a lovely framework for figuring which assets you should be focusing on in the future that are going to be more powerful.
Which you have translated in a wonderful drawing around the distinctive assets of England.
Oh, have you seen the English one?
Yeah, I've seen the English one. It's wonderful.
When Queen Elizabeth II died, I had this surprising sadness. Well, I didn't realise, because I'm not a particular monarchist or anything, but most people in Britain have an affection for the royal family, I would say, even if they're not a big fan of the concept. And I did this diagram, which is on my website, about the assets.
Yeah. And let's try to explain it, because I think that most people can envision this very quickly.
Imagine.
So you have the basically four fields, like things that are unknown and are not attributed to you. Nobody cares.
Yep.
And then there are things that are very well known, like like football, for example. Everybody knows football, but is it uniquely attributed to England?
It's not. No, it's not. Like cricket, I think of cricket because cricket's even more. You could say it's, you know, particularly associated with the UK, but no, it's not. It's actually more associated with India or equally with Australia and South Africa. They're all cricketing nations, so they love cricket. So yes, UK is associated with cricket, but not uniquely.
You know, and then the right upper corner, you tell us what is in
the right
upper corner.
The top right, the best stuff. Oh, yeah.
The best stuff.
Well, the Westminster Tower, the Big Ben, they call it. It's not Big Ben, is actually the bell, but that's not important right now. You have the Busby, the guards with the huge, fluffy black helmets. I can't remember now.
The flag itself? The flag
Yeah, the Union flag with the colors. And the shape, any flag is unique to its own country. Those are the kind of things that are the most powerful distinctive brand assets. Yeah. And if I was doing Tourism England, I would use those. And then the box I love to talk about, which is the box that's unique to Britain or almost unique to Britain, but no one's ever heard of.
like the Christmas cracker thing.
Yeah, Christmas cracker. Well, apparently there are some other countries that have Christmas crackers, but Christmas crackers, where you pull apart, you pull them apart at Christmas, you have to wear the hat, you have to say the little stupid joke on it, and you have a little prize. That's quite uniquely British, but no one's heard of it. And Eton Fives. I love talking about Eton Fives. Eton, as in there's a famous public school in Britain called Eton, where they have this bizarre sport called Fives, which is like, the closest thing I can think of is like squash, but without a back wall and with this straight. Look, it takes too long to explain, but the point is, I was quite good at squash, even though I'm really, really short, right? I was quite good at squash because height isn't a disadvantage in this particular game. Apparently there are two or three fives courts in Germany, so it's not quite unique. Yeah, I don't know where they are. You can look it up.
We'll look it up. Yeah, but that illustration is a perfect example of how you translate really deep knowledge, like the Jenny Romanyuk framework, and it's very beautiful. And we'll link it in the show notes.
Okay, there. Thanks. So, it's one of my favorites because I love those quirky British traditions like cheese rolling and conkers. But anyway, you can look up those up
as it's really good. I used it in the seminars as well to explain the concept. Yeah, and so. My last questions to you is, it's also a distinctive brand asset of this podcast, is like, you have the chance, like, because we want to impart knowledge and inspire people, and you have the chance to put a screensaver on a computer of all CMOs and marketing executives for a month. What would it say?
I did debate this because I asked you earlier, you know, to remind me of this final question. Oh, there are so many. The trouble is I've come up with a slightly negative one.
Go ahead.
But I think it's okay. Because I think it's probably the thing that will trigger CMOs to just be authentic in their marketing kind of thing. It's something like, customers don't care much about your brand.
Right. Okay. Be humble. Be aware. Customers don't care so much about your brand.
I find that useful when I'm in my training, because it's like there is still a lingering thought that marketing effectiveness can be maximized by focusing on loyalty. You know, people who love your brand, trying to build a strong emotional bond with your brand and get more people to feel this amazing emotional bond with your brand. And yet we know the data is such that, yes, there are people. There are a few people who love certain brands, absolutely love them and will always buy them. But it doesn't make any difference to your commercial success. You know, it's trivial. It's tiny. And actually, you need to focus on building your penetration, using reach to do that. And that's how you build a brand and being inclusive and building more people. And that's more important. So people don't care much. So just remind them and keep thinking mass. Think more mass. Yeah, you get my drift.
Okay, and that's your filter, how to think about your marketing.
Yes.
Think of the least disinterested person out there and make it like
make
some
it relevant
visible,
for them.
Visible for him
visible
and relevant for
and
him.
Vaguely and relevant.
So, okay.
And maybe put it into their, what do you call it, consideration set.
Yeah.
If you do that, it'll also, at the same time, reinforce why you're fairly loyal people. It'll help them as well. So focus on that and you'll win.
Okay. Guys out there, remember, your brand is not that all important for the people out there. Dan, this was just great. I feel deeply grateful for your time and
no,
your valuable insights.
Thank you, Olaf. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll wish you lots of success with your books and teaching, and I'll link everything in the show notes and tell everybody about you. And is there any resource in particular that you would like me to mention now that you want to point people to?
I'm most proud of my website. Yes.
Okay.
It's quite simple. It's smartmarketing.me.
What is it? Smart marketing.
Smartmarketing.me.
Okay.
That's it.
Guys, go there.
I'm very proud of it because it basically includes pretty much every illustration I've ever done in some logical
way. And you're amazingly generous with this. So I can only advise people to go there. It's a fantastic resource. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.